Parker, thank you so much for being here today. I'd love to go back to the beginning and have you tell me the journey before Tuff.
Yeah. So I started Tuff about 4 years ago. So before that, I studied marketing and finance. I went to school down in the States in good old Indiana. So the University of Indianapolis, I got a sports scholarship down there and started in marketing. And then kind of as all students should, I just started kind of like bugging everybody in the industry, like DMing people. I'd spent every day kind of DMing at least like five people in marketing in all landscapes. I was talking to like sports agents. I was talking to people in agencies, people working for brands, and eventually got connected to some really cool people who just gave me some insight. It was just on the last podcast I was in, I was talking about this guy and I even said this. I was like, I talk about him so much, he probably doesn't remember me at all. I ended up connecting with Dylan Jacob, who was Forbes 30 Under 30, and he started the company Brewmate. Brewmate's a Yeti competitor, like insulated.
Yeah.
They've grown to like $100 million plus brand now, but this was like early days. He lived in Indianapolis and I bought him a beer and I was like, hey, I'm in marketing, kind of generalize right now. What areas like do you recommend or do you see the future? And he's like, well, the reason Brewmate grew so fast was because of Facebook ads. This was what, 8 years ago. And that was like in the heyday of Facebook ads. And he's like, you should see what I pay my Facebook ads guy and what he's done for my company. And started really playing around with it, went home, bought every online course in Facebook ads, and then approached a company back here in Vancouver for like an internship. I said, I'm studying digital marketing. I'll do anything digital marketing wise. And they're like SEO and Facebook ads. And I said, yeah, I'm an expert in both. But I didn't even actually know what SEO stood for. So I just went home and bought all courses on SEO, realized I hated SEO because of just, I think SEO is like the most crucial thing for a business, but it's just very long term. And there's a lot of work that goes into it for like 6 months of then seeing rewards, where Facebook ads is very like immediate. And I love that fast response. So then I really doubled down and started working for every company I could for free through college, and then post-college graduated with quite the resume of managing a decent amount on Facebook, and got the job at Daily Hive, the media company based here in Vancouver, and worked there for 2 years. And they kind of threw me the keys to their digital advertising, where I managed a pretty substantial budget and learned everything under the sun when it came to digital marketing. And then kind of slowly spiraled into getting a couple clients on the side. And then I started Tuff, but yeah, it was probably the early days of like learning Facebook ads and then Daily Hive that were like very crucial in starting Tuff Media.
Yeah, and so it sounds like you're really savvy with just being bold enough to reach out to people, pick their brain, offer them something through internships and things like that. If someone's in that university stage right now, what would you recommend that they do?
Yeah, and I still do that. I always have mentors and advisors. I usually have like 2 to 3. And I hit this way bigger, better people doing way cooler things than me. And how I have always got introduced to them was just me DMing them. I think we're in this day and age where there's so many people are, you can access them by just like a message. And I think people usually are reserved to do that because of just the fear of rejection. But after that, you kind of get used to it. And even on our mentor, when we were doing the speed dating of mentorships with people, I gave that advice to so many people. It was like, go, don't like harass people and do the generic LinkedIn DM, like provide some value, provide some insight. There's even one advisor I had where I was DMing him every 3 months, just updating him on my company. And he was never replying to me. I was like, hey, I'm starting my own company. 3 months later, hey, got my first few clients. Hey, started hiring people. And just, we eventually got connected and he just like scrolled up in his LinkedIn. He's like, wow, you've just been updating me every 3 months. And now he's like an advisor of mine. So I think that's how I've created any little bit of success in my world, is just always having people that have been there, done that, of what I want to achieve. And they don't tell me what to do. It's just whenever I'm at a crossroads, I usually go to them and say, hey, these are the crossroads. And they're 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh, I was at similar crossroads 8 years ago. This is what happened to me. This is everything you should like look into and weigh as options. I think it helps. Entrepreneurship can be lonely. So I think having people like that have been through the grind really help. And I'm always doing that, messaging people to see if I can get a little 15-minute virtual coffee from them or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do so much of that too. I think that's how we met. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so for anyone that isn't familiar with TUF, can you give me a bit of a high-level overview of the agency?
Yeah. So TUF, we're a performance marketing agency specializing in direct-to-consumer. So Shopify brands are probably 90 to 95% of our clientele is Shopify brands. So anywhere from brands spending $10,000 to $20,000 a month to now spending like seven figures a month with some brands. And paid ad management is the majority of the services we provide, but also we're kind of going into, and just overall performance marketing is going into this creative-led performance marketing. So the magic is now in the creative. Now either sourcing UGC, creating our own creatives is a big one now, and ad management, as well as the retention and lifecycle marketing, so, like the email and SMS. Those are kind of the main three suite of services, but all for direct-to-consumer brands.
Cool. And I'm curious as well, because you are very niche down within your agency, and I know that when we started Oko, we were niche down within social media management, and then as clients wanted more, we felt compelled to expand. So I'm curious if you ever felt the draw to expand your offerings, or if you always wanted to stay really niche down.
Yeah. Oh, I have tried, and it. I think it depends on what you want to build. I think if you're building an amazing like kind of lifestyle or generalized marketing arm, that is for sure a value. Like a lot of actually brands need that, is just somebody they can trust with quite a few things marketing. But if you're trying to build a bit of a brand or just kind of a larger entity that you can then hire and train and process, that's where the niching down really comes into. So when we first started, that was probably the earlier mistakes I was doing, was just kind of saying yes to a lot of things that have just, if the money was there, then yeah, because I had people I was responsible for keeping food on the table and then employees then with paychecks. But then as we've kind of grown now, we're at about, over the last 3 years now, we've grown from just me starting to now about a team of 16 full-time. The riches are in the niches, I think, is because then it's so much easier to create a process, create an iteration of, and hey, this is our playbook and this is how we serve our playbook. And these are the type of clients we've created the playbook for. It's really helped us in that sense, whereas compared to the earlier days when we were doing a lot of different things for different niches, it was more of, we're just consistently problem solving, where now we can be more proactive, or at least we're getting there, of being more proactive because our clients are so similar. So it's helped us in the sense of operations for sure. It's harder in the sense of sales to a degree, whereas then when a client does come that's in our ICP or in our niche, I find it very easy to sell them because it's like, yeah, we know exactly what you're looking for. We do it for 30 plus other brands. But then you do have to be comfortable with saying no to things and like walking away when it doesn't fit your ICP, which we do a lot of, and we're probably going to be doing even a lot more of moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Aside from them being outside of your niche, is there anything that you look out for in terms of red flags of clients that you wouldn't take on?
Yeah. So we have quite a few kind of like just boxes to check off when kind of establishing if the client is in our ICP. And one of those is, I mean, we like to integrate well within the team, but it is a lot of work scaling a brand through performance marketing. We do have quite a bit of founder-led brands, but we do like our brands to have at least somebody internally on the marketing side that we can collaborate with. Like, I'm a founder, I'm terrible to get a hold of sometimes. Like, it is really, you're just pulled in all sorts of directions. So if our point of contact is the founder, that sometimes can be not a hard no, just a question mark. Hey, are you up for this? Are we going to be waiting on things from you? So that's one of them. The product, e-commerce is getting harder and harder in today's age. Like, it's not 4 years ago when cost of advertising was low and everybody was sitting at home getting stimulus checks and surfing the internet for what's the best deal. Like, it's a weird economy right now. People have money, people don't have money. So you have to really convince people to buy your product, and the cost of advertising is getting high. So the average order value is actually a big thing that we like to qualify for. If you're selling $20 products, that's really hard to scale with e-commerce, where if you're selling $200 products, that's a lot easier. So little things like that. And then also just overall, how long have you been around? That's a big one. We do work with some startups, but not majority of our clients are startups. It's just a whole different suite of things that you need. Startups are really hard, but also I love working with startups because, I mean, everybody was a startup one day, right? So yeah. But probably more established brands we're now working with. So doing at least like around $1 million a year in sales. That's kind of all those check boxes are falling more into our ICP now.
You say that your strategies are tough enough to weather anything, which is where the name comes from. And so what does that actually look like when managing client work?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So that's kind of how when I started the company, people were asking, what do you want to be known for? And that's how we came up with the name was I started the company in COVID. So I was like, well, I want to create marketing campaigns that, you know, strong enough to go through any obstacle or macro event. So what do I call that? Strong marketing? No, it's tough. And so, and then it's also turned into the new kind of branding of us is like, we'll have the tough conversation with you. So like going from A to B, that's not easy. That's very tough, but we're here for that challenge. And we're here to kind of be very transparent with you of what's not working, what is working. So when we're creating like strategies that we think that even now in today's economy, not everything is working and not everything is driving. It's not, again, the heyday of Facebook ads where everything's just a 5 to 6x return on ad spend. You have to really work hard for those results. So what we're doing now, like I said, is being more creative led. So at a very high level, you kind of have to do research before executing. So what are the emotional motivators of the consumer you're trying to go after? If you can pull on those heartstrings in the first 3 to 5 seconds of your ad, you'll most likely stop them from scrolling and it increases your chances of converting. So what is the emotional motivator that we're trying to speak to in this ad? And then you can have multiple, but you shouldn't have 10, but let's have multiple that we can speak to. And then what format? Okay, is it an unboxing? Is it a testimonial? Is it a montage? Like, so we just try to break it down by stage, and it's usually the heavier lifting is on the creative side. The executing on the media buying, that's the distribution system. But if you can start testing and iterating fast and pivoting creatively while having that distribution system through your ads, that's how you win in e-commerce. And that's like the tough strategy that can go through no matter if a recession happens, a nationwide virus that happens. You can, if you pull on the correct emotional motivators through your ads, you can actually go through those weird macro events.
It sounds like you keep tabs on the industry carefully in order to know, of course, what strategies to be using for your clients. Are there any specific ways that you do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one part I love about digital marketing is being 10 years in digital marketing actually doesn't give you a moat. The strategies change every month, it seems like right now, like every three to six months, there's a new strategy that you can implement. So I like that because you have to be on the leading edge of the industry then of what's working, what's and testing new ideas. And then every day is in the exact same. So what's working right now, it kind of depends. There's quite a bit of trends that if you jump on trends with social media and then adapt it into a creative advertising lens, that works out really well. As well as then there's just different formats. We have like 15 to 20 formats that are working really well in terms of video. Video is still doing really well for direct-to-consumer brands. However, the lifespan of the video has gotten short because not only has like the actual length of the video has gotten shorter with just the rise of TikTok, but the lifespan of you running an ad as a video, you probably have to change out ads now almost every 30 days. Whereas before, brands could probably run a good ad for 3 to 4 months. Whereas now just the consumer just needs more, needs different motivators to speak to, or speaking to the same motivator, but just with different demographics, like different scenarios. Sometimes I've had an ad that works and then I've refilmed it the exact same script, but just a different setting, maybe a different overlay, and it refreshes and it works just as well. So I think the creative flow of monthly content that, and you know what to create is really important. And that it's kind of high level. There's an exact strategy that works for every brand, but at least having that and being ready or lean enough, especially from an e-commerce stand to pivot that fast. That's how you create success with creatives. It's just, let's test. Okay, find what works, then double down on those. And then every month you should just be creating new ads, 70% of what's working, 30% on testing new ideas. But the majority should be based off performance.
Definitely. Yeah. And I mean, that's pretty much the exact strategy we have for organic social as well. So always good to hear that we're thinking alike.
It's like connecting like right brain with left brain. Like there's the creative side and there's the analytical side, but you actually just kind of have to speak to both. And that's what I like. I've never been leaning more towards the creative. Like I'm the worst graphic designer in the world, but I can look at a spreadsheet and look at analytics and then start connecting the dots through creative and then understand why that's working, like why that hook rate's working, why that thumb stop ratio is working, and then creating I think digesting the data and then translating that to your clients or to your brands is really important. So it's like that merge of analytical yet creative, which again, that why I love the industry, is you do both, not just one or the other.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Mm-hmm. And what early bets did you make within Tuff that paid off, or even before?
Yeah, I mean, quite a few. I mean, I guess the early bets, I mean, all through college, like I was a starving student but just worked for free for years, like earned my stripes. So I mean, those paid off huge, because then I got to the interview at Daily Hive, where they get hundreds and hundreds of applicants. And I pretty much told them, like, I think left the interview saying, and I remember my manager telling me this after I got hired, was like, that was really helpful. I was like, I'm sure you'll have people with more experience, but I will work my effing ass off. And I hope my resume shows that. Like, I just worked for 4 years for free for multiple companies while being a student, while being a full-time athlete, and like getting, so just that's the effort that I'll show. And they're like, yeah, it does. So I think those early bets of just working late nights, like while people were doing college things and I was stuck there like running Facebook ads for drop shipping companies for free on a like Thursday, Friday night, that really paid off. And then as well, like when I went full-time for a Tuff, like there's always that moment where like as an entrepreneur, you're like, all right, do I just do this thing or do I just keep doing it on the side, where having a paycheck plus doing a side hustle is so comfortable. I loved it. Like there's so much security, but I knew I eventually wanted to build something. So that was I only went full time and Tuff when I had like two clients. And so,
and tell me about what that was like. Like what made you make the leap? Was it just one day you felt ready, or was there like a number you needed to hit, or any metrics that you were considering?
Definitely wasn't a number, because when I went full time, I was not making much money. Thankfully, I was like living in the parents' basement and could have that flexibility. The actual, I would say, moment was my first two clients really started to see the results that I created, and I helped their business. And it was one of my first two clients that called me and was like, you should do this full time because you've like really helped my business, like genuinely. And I just got so much energy from that, and like self-fulfillment and rewarding. I think, was it fun? But I actually like helped somebody grow income, grow, and I can talk the talk now. I can walk the walk, and gave me some like a little bit of confidence. And I was raised by entrepreneurs. Like my family owns their own business. So I knew eventually this was the road, and kind of just weighed all the options. I was like, hey, well, I'm living in the parents' basement. My costs are pretty low. I was like 22 at the time or something like that. If there's any moment, it's now. Why I have like low responsibility. And then when I talked to Daily Hive and Carm, who was the CEO and owner of Daily Hive, when I had that meeting with him, that even gave me even more energy, because he was so supportive with it. Like he's one of my mentors and advisors today, and we even do like different business ventures together. I think it was that meeting that I was like, oh man, this is gonna be fun, because I kind of went in there quitting, and he was okay, well, we're going to meet once a month. I'm going to introduce you to these people, and they're going to help you get started. And I was like, man, I want to do this for somebody one day. So, all those things like really helped. And then when you do go full time, just like the network effect, then people at Daily Hive started telling other people that, hey, I know a guy that runs ads now for full time. They started introducing me to new clients. So two clients turned to five clients, turned to seven clients, turned to 10 clients. I would say in the matter of, I don't know, by the end of the first year, that's when I was looking to hire full time. And so it was a crazy first year, and I was just obsessed with doing really great work for my first few clients, which then led to a bunch of referrals. But I did it on the side for about a year and a half, I would say, or a year while I was at Daily Hive. So that was fun, but it was just long days, long hours. And then there's never going to be an exact moment that I think like your house can burn down tomorrow. Right? Stuff can always go wrong. But, I think that there was a moment that I felt like I had some validation, and then I learned everything under the sun of maybe I wasn't ready, but as like an entrepreneur, you kind of just move fast, break things and fix things.
Definitely.
Fly almost.
Fly the plane while you're building it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I always find that interesting to hear from people because I feel like people's approach of when to go full time with it is so different. So I always find that to be an interesting one. And then let's go completely the other direction and talk about the biggest challenges that you face.
Yeah, so I think there was three main biggest challenges. Over the last 3 years, there was the entrepreneur and founder. You kind of have to be, what is it, a chameleon? Is that like the changing? Yeah. Like a chameleon. You kind of have to like evolve. And one of my mentors, coach, advisor, whatever you want to call them. I kind of hate to say the word like mentors and coach just because like, I don't know, social media sometimes is like fluffed up, but that's what they are. They're a coach essentially. He gave me this lesson. It's called like the law of the lid. Is you always, as a founder and a leader of a company, have to be raising your lid because no 9 out of 10 or no person that has their lid up here is going to want to come work for somebody that has their lid down here. Not saying you have to be the smartest person in the world, but at least improving and knowing and constantly increasing your knowledge is crucial. And so over the last 3 years, there's been like three main, I would say, challenges that I've had to really increase my lid or like teach myself this new. And that was when I was first starting, I was just good at Facebook and Google Ads. And so I was like, okay, I'm good at the service. Let's start offering the service. It went well. I could have stopped there and just had a handful of clients and been the executor and lived a great lifestyle business. But I was like, no, let's build something here. So then I had to go from that to then hiring on employees and contractors. And they did the output and I did the management. So I kind of had to learn to be like a manager.
It's a really tough thing to learn when you start your business. Yeah, because we had that too, where it was, you know, I think I was 22 also when we started Oko. And, you know, it starts with, you doing the service yourself. And then when all of a sudden it's managing a team and you've barely been even managed by others at that point, it's really tough to learn
a whole new bottle of anxiety that comes with it, right? So that was the first transition. Is I never even managed somebody before. Okay, well now I have to learn this. And you can't be not confident while managed people. You're like, I think this is how we do it. Like, listen, you're not gonna be a great manager, right? So that was that first kind of ceiling I hit. It was like, okay, I gotta teach myself how to be a good manager. And then at that point then led to like growth and hiring full time and how to get leaders in the door. And I was like, okay, now I have to be a really good HR person, attract good talent. And that was the next year. And that went, made a bunch of mistakes there, but eventually have been making leaps there. And now that we're at 16 and I have like a leadership team coming in and really smart people, now I'm having to be an actual like CEO and leader and lead the people that are the managers, a whole different ball game, right? So those would be probably the most pivotal transition moments of me just having to take a step back and be like, okay, I've now learned a new skill set or raise my lid here. And I have to, and how I immediately go to raise my lid is go get mentors and advisors and coaches that have done that, can really meet with me weekly and be hands-on approach. And that those were probably the 2 to 3 like, hardest times. And I'm still learning. Nowhere near perfect, but this is the next chapter. The latest one is me being an actual CEO and leading a team of really experienced and A players.
And any skills that you've learned about management that you would share with someone that is going through that first transition that you talked about?
Yeah, so it actually got simplified to me by Peter Holgate and Jordan West. Those were like my two kind of advisors. And they summarized it in a way that was really digestible for me. It was just strength-based organization, engagement-oriented, and performance-focused. So strength-based organization, know everybody's strengths. Step one. So we use Clifton Strengths, amazing tool. I think a lot of Fortune 500 companies use it. Go measure everybody's strengths. Kind of spits out, and you learn a lot even from that. Okay, this person's competitive, this person's not. Stop making that person be so competitive. And then with that, you start realizing that you have spiky people and you don't really want these well-rounded people. You want spiky people. You want people strong in different areas and then pair them up with people that are strong in other areas. So I have Ryan is my head of partnerships and sales. He's an amazing strategic thinker. I'm not. I'm a futuristic thinker. I'm a learner. I'm an executor. But essentially what that means is I sometimes can't create the checklist that I have to check to get from A to B. Like that's the strategic thinker. If I get a checklist sent to me, I will crush that and I will execute. So sometimes I use his strength as, hey, this is the problem I'm facing. I got to get here to here. Like, what do you think I should prioritize? How do you think I should prioritize at first? And then he can help me like, okay, I would do this, this, and this first. I'm like, cool, you're done. I'm good now. So like strength partnerships is the big one. So, and then engagement oriented, I think is one that people sleep on a lot. People need, like, that's culture to me. Culture, that's the biggest one I'm learning right now is we've kind of muscled our way to where we are. And now to get to the next step is culture. And I've always hated this side of, you know, even like podcasts and like blogs. When I read people, I'm like, oh, just tell me what to do. Don't give me the fluff. And honestly, I haven't realized it until now of how crucial the fluff is and the culture. Peter Drucker, I think, said it, like, culture eats strategy for breakfast. You can be the most strategic organization in the world, but if you don't just have a bunch of people that are aligned in what you're building or in the mission, you'll have poor culture or you'll have some bad apples that will then ruin your culture, right? So that's the engagement oriented, is be engaged in every meeting, know our core values, represent our core values, interact with the people when your manager's not there, like your manager's there, and like with your core values. And then performance focus is give everybody KPIs that can summarize, if you do your job effectively and we're following our North Star, we get here. And so hit these KPIs. And so if you just combine all those three statements as strength-based, engagement-oriented, performance focus, you can really build something cool.
Yeah, I love the way you broke that down. So simplified and yet covers everything. I feel like I'm going to, when I'm editing this, I'm going to take some notes on that one.
Yeah, no, it was really, that's like those things with those experienced people when you're like, oh, I got all these problems, and they give you something so simple, you're like, oh. But that just means you have a good coach, advisor.
Yes. Tell me one thing that you find a lot of early stage businesses get wrong when they're trying to manage their paid ads. So I'm talking like small business trying to run their ads themselves.
Okay, I'd say a lot of this. So there's a couple things. I think businesses get into paid ads too early at times. Mm-hmm. You can do that, but you just have to have the right mindset's the wrong word, but yeah, I have to be able to stomach what you're doing. So I talk to a lot of startup businesses. I even work with LOI, League of Innovators, like an amazing accelerator. I was in it, and now I'm helping their teach or consult with all their startups, and get that question all the time. Early stage business, I want to get into paid ads. We need more traffic. Okay, you can, but I recommend doing the hard part first. Like, go, really corny analogy, I might have even said this to you before, but like, paid ads needs to be looked at as the gasoline on the fire, not the entire fire. Like, so if you've ever gone camping, you have to build a foundation. So like, build the wood, build everything, and then get the fire going, and then pour the gasoline on. And then once you stop the gasoline, the fire will have grown and be an amazing bonfire. Whereas if you don't do the hard part, which is building a brand, knowing your customer audience, knowing those emotional motivators, doing all the competitor research of like, and getting your organic sales to a great spot, if you don't do that and you just go right into paid ads, you're kind of just lighting a match and pouring gasoline on. And yeah, you'll get traffic, you'll get clicks, you might get some sales, but as soon as that gasoline gets turned off, the fire goes away. And you're kind of in this pay to play game. And that is a very, I know brands that have done that. A lot of them are like venture-backed brands that, hey, we just raised a bunch of money, let's just throw it into marketing and see what happens. Again, there's nothing wrong with that, but there's multiple avenues to driving sales, especially for direct-to-consumer. And so what we like to look at is like the 30-30-30 with 10% floating. So 30% of revenue should be coming from organic or direct, 30% should be coming from like your retention, email or SMS, and then 30% coming from paid ads. That's 90%, and then you can have 10% floating from either bucket. That's a really healthy direct-to-consumer. Companies that are like 80% coming from paid ads. What if Zuckerberg wakes up one day and suspends your ad account? It's pretty scary, right? It happens all the time. So I always advise people to go do the hard part first, or if you're going to start in paid ads, just have very low expectations for the first 6 months. Not only are you figuring out the business, the algorithms are figuring out the business. So I think that mistake, people go into paid ads as like the savior of their business, or like, oh, this will help. No, you're kind of just avoiding this hard part. Whereas we've talked to businesses that have gone and done the hard part, and then they come to paid ads, and it's like lightning in a bottle. It works so well. Like, we had this one company we work with for a while now, So Luxury. They're based in Langley, and there are these two moms that created this product. Their kid had eczema, and so they created this homemade remedy and started packaging up, and they just slowly built this like amazing, healthy business. And they came to us, and they're like, we don't really know what we're doing, but they're doing great sales. And then we fired up ads, and it's been the most insane returns for them, like, because they went and did the hard part and we were just the gasoline.
Yeah. So what would you define as those kind of pieces of the fire that need to be put in place before the gasoline then?
Your branding, know your brand positioning, know why people buy your products. I've talked to so many brands. So I've gone into another example was like a supplement company I talked to, and they were like, I asked them, who's your core demographic? Who are we selling to? And they said, young guys trying to add muscle. Odds are the founders were young guys trying to build muscle. So I'm like, okay, so you created the product. I went into their back end. I was like, you're like 60, 70% of your traffic is female, but like none of your ads have a female demographic in it. So that's just a great example of founders that like put blinders on. They create something just for themselves, which a lot of founders do, but then they just ignore the data. So know who's coming and who's buying your product already. Have some proof first. So get organic sales in well before getting paid ads. Go do the hard part. So I like to say at least get to like 10, 20, 30K a month in organic sales. That's a good number to then start talking to your customers. Why did you buy this? What problems did it solve? And then you can go to an ad partner or even yourself and be like, hey, we're solving these problems. This is our brand positioning. This is our core demographic. Like this is the avatar. And then you can go do competitor research to the brands that are 1,000 times your size. What formats are they doing? Is it unboxing, testimonials? And it's just a good old like kind of rip and duplicate, but with your brand.
Okay, so if you were dropped into a startup with 5K to test ads, what would you do?
5K to test ads. Okay, so I would spend the first month not spending anything on ads. I would go do exactly everything. So I would go right away to Meta Ad Library, go find probably the top 5 direct-to-consumer competitors that have $1 million or more a month that they're spending on ads. And I would go just find all the patterns under the sun. The companies, even if they're not on the same exact product, but if I would find who is the core demographic we're going after and go find brands that are advertising directly to those people. If it's males, females, whatever it is, okay, now let's go find people that are either in our space or just advertising directly to those. Then I'd start writing down, okay, what are all the emotional motors? Is it a convenience? Is it a money saver? Is it a time saver? Is it a health thing? Like what are they speaking to in that first hook? And I'd start writing down patterns. Then I'd go to the formats. What formats are they using? And start writing down patterns. Once you start doing this, it's actually very easy to see these formats when you have the lists in front of you. You go to these brands that have thousands of active ads. And then you can just, okay, out of the 1,000 they have 500 unboxing. That's probably working for them really well. So I'd go do that. Go start finding all the emotional motors. If it's not a startup, I'd go start speaking to the customers. So I'd do that same. Just a little survey. Hey, what made you buy it? Why did you buy it? What problem did it solve for? So get some first party in. If it's a startup, they probably don't have that luxury because there's no consumers. So I just go heavy into customer research. And then I would go crazy on content. I would just start building every piece of content under the 4 to 5 formats that I found through my competitor research with the 4 to 5 emotional motivators I also found. And I would start interchanging them. One ad can be the exact same from 75% of the ad can be the exact same. And I just change out that hook 5 different times to the different emotional motivators. One ad can turn to 5 ads and I would do that multiple times. So I'd have like a bucket of 25 to 40 ads that I could run. And then if I'm just given $5,000 and it's very early stage of startup, I'd put all of that into social ads. So Meta ads usually. The reason I do that is I'm sure a lot of people are like, well, Google ads work really well. Totally. But for startup, you kind of want testing and feedback instantly. So that's what's great for Meta is you can then go have all these different ads, organize them by the emotional motivator and the format, run them all, and you'll probably find success, not in total, but you'd be able to leave that first month, spend $5,000 and be like, great, these 2 emotional motivators worked really well. These 3 formats worked really well. So now for the next month, I know exactly what to create and what to keep doubling down. And I guess before running all that, I would also do some accounting of what is like a profitable cost per acquisition, a profitable return on ad spend. And then that's how I would determine the winners, which ones achieved that cost per acquisition, achieved that ROAS, and then what was in the ads. And then I'd create a new bucket of those ads, but following all the top performing winners. I'd spend another $5,000, and probably by month 3, you'd be spending, you know, $10,000 to $15,000 at the end of all this, but you'd have probably quite a bit of success coming out of that. It's very high level and it sounds easy, but you'd be surprised how many brands just don't even do that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think that's the case with so many digital marketing things, right? It sounds easy until you do it wrong, and then it's not so easy. What's been the hardest part about building Tuff that no one warned you about?
Yes. So I was warned going into starting my own company. Like, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of hours. That never shied me away from it. I love long hours. I love building something. To be honest, the part that I don't think maybe I was warned or I just didn't take into consideration was the mental fatigue. I think in today's day and age, like entrepreneurship is so sexy. Like it's Lamborghinis and private jets. And nope, that's not the case. If you're getting into entrepreneurship, to make a lot of money, you're probably not doing it right, because yeah. I've never felt broker at times. I've never lost as much money as I have having a paycheck. So you actually really got to go into it for the right reason. I went into it because I just knew that I wanted to be in full control of my input and output. So I think I went into starting my business the most mentally sound guy, happy-go-lucky, never had any issues with like mental health or anything. And starting your own business, it tests that. And so like the anxiety of like having all these different personalities when you start hiring, like the decision fatigue, all that, I think somebody really has to check themselves before diving headfirst into entrepreneurship is not, am I ready to just put the effort in? To be honest, the effort's the hard, easy part. It's, am I willing to take like the mental beating every week? Because entrepreneurship is defined as just taking the greater financial risk. But it's also, I kind of define it as, who can just get punched in the face the most and get back up again? Can you mentally just, your day is just problem solving at a certain scale. I got into this because I liked running Facebook ads. I don't do that anymore. All I do is problem solve. It's rewarding and motivating, but it gets mentally taxing quite a bit. So, and not that I talk anybody out of entrepreneurship. I love it. It's a drug now to me. I will never work for anybody ever again. I will never go back. It's amazing. But I do, whenever somebody comes to me and says, I want to start my business, I'd be like, great. How are you mentally right now without starting your business? Hopefully you're 100 out of 100. You're great, because that's about to get tested, like really, really severe. So hopefully that's not negative, but it's just one thing that I didn't think would be part of it as much.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. Yeah. And I think especially having started our businesses at the same age, maybe mm-hmm. you'll relate to this, but I found that one of the biggest challenges for me from a mental health standpoint was that I felt like I had just kind of recently become responsible for myself. And then within, you know, such a short time frame of becoming responsible for my own life, I was responsible for a corporation and a team. And I just felt like I'm getting like sweaty palms even just thinking back to that time, because it's just like, it's just so many things at the same time, so many things to learn. And I think as like a perfectionist, I put so much pressure on myself to do it so well. And then also on the point of never feeling broker at times, I was at Startup Week last week, and there was a founder on a panel talking about how they made a big investment into their branding. And then she was at a coffee meeting with her co-founder and, you know, someone else the next week, and they were having to transfer funds from their personal bank accounts and the business bank account to combine it all together to just pay for this coffee meeting. And she was crying. A bunch of people in the audience were crying, because it's like so many people have been there with entrepreneurship. And I feel like it's something that's not often talked about. Like you said, entrepreneurship is so sexy right now and so glorified. And I think that that's where building a community is so important, because, you know, your friends that are working a 9-to-5, like they just will never understand those particular struggles in the same way. And I think that having a community of entrepreneurs is so important. It sounds like you were saying that you're involved with LOI. Are there any other communities that you found to be beneficial with that?
LOI is amazing. Even like my clients, I have actual like really great relationships with that we talk about outside of like the digital marketing. It's just like, how are you guys doing? And just want to just vent. And so I'm lucky enough to get introduced to so many entrepreneurs because I'm in the service-based business. And so I get connected with so many. So I've kind of like almost built my own little community of just in my own shell. But LOI is great, as well as like the mentors. I've even gone to like Founders Club, which is great. Yeah, it helps. So it's so, and just honestly, podcasts, like there's podcasts I've listened to. This could have just been about me. Hey guys, like to relate so well. And it's so nice when a seasoned entrepreneur is like, oh, this is usually when you're in this stage of business, you're going through these problems. You're like, yeah, I'm going through that problem. Or I read a book the other day. I was reading Traction, the EOS book. And the first chapter, it was like, you're probably reading this book because of this, this, and this. I'm like, oh my God, this is literally everything I just described about my day to day. So there's so many resources out there that I think help, and just even those little things, I'm like, okay, cool. That gives me some comfort of like, I'm not alone. Every entrepreneur goes to this. And that was one thing I've learned over the 3 years, is like, just what's the worst case that can happen? Like, but also that feeling that you highlighted is when you start getting employees and team members, oh man, it's like a whole new ball game for me. When it was just me, that was cool. It was fun. I was just responsible. I was just working 12 hours a day, making good money. And it was like, this is awesome. This is what entrepreneurship is. And then I got team. I was like, wait a minute. Oh, okay, so now I'm responsible. You mean I have team members now. Kids.
That's like, exactly what I was thinking of. Like, it's when they have kids, it really hits you, especially when you don't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're like, they have a whole another set of responsibilities to their family.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm responsible for them fulfilling that.
It's yep. Oh, I got it. Yeah, I got multiple employees with kids. And I've met them. I've met like my employees, like partners who then I feel a connection with. Like, and it's hard as being the business owner because you want to make every decision for the group to weigh everybody's opinions and be like, I want to make this decision for the group. And you sometimes can't. You have to make the decision that is the best for the organization as a whole because they will lead to then everybody being satisfied and want and like. Financially and operationally and everything. So there was a certain stage where I could make every decision and just get everybody's opinion and be like, cool, I'm making this decision for the group. And there's a certain point where you're like, okay, now I have to make the decision for the organization and the highest average and not, and just what we're trying to build here, not what everybody's personality is asking me to do, which is, that's really struggling. And that is one thing that I don't think I ever anticipated was weighing that stress of meeting people's families and being like, cool, it's up to you to make sure this paycheck comes in every 2 weeks so we can buy diapers. Like, oh man, that's hard.
Yeah, it's heavy.
Yeah.
How has your idea of success changed since starting the agency?
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think I'd be flawed to say that when I first started, like there was a number. I was like, I got to make this amount of money to make this worth it. It like quickly changed that when that's all vanity to me now. For now, like what success is, operational excellence with actually helping all of our clients and making sure that what we're saying, what we're preaching, we're executing on and doing it in a way that's operationally sound for internal team members and external clients. I think also like building something that one, I hope I work with majority of my team forever, but if I don't, if people do leave the organization, then they will have grown so exponentially and then even maybe even started their own thing, but at least building something that people can enter and then grow so rapidly that then they go do bigger and better things, that would be so successful to me. That would make everything worth it.
And I'm curious as well how you view growth for the business versus growth for yourself personally.
Good question. Growth for the business, I mean, obviously there's like the accounting side of it. So like revenue, profit, that's easy. But like staff retention, client retention, that's also a big one, as well as like net promoter scores. You can measure all those things. So we have KPIs. That's like that performance oriented thing I was saying of like, okay, if we're checking these, we're growing and we're growing internally, externally, and financially. Great. So always, we always have account of that, as well as team members growing in their role or growing into new roles, I think is really exciting as well. And then personally, what is growth for me? Honestly, it's a really good question.
It's tough, right? Your personal growth can sometimes get so intertwined with your business or your identity can also become so intertwined.
Yeah. A year ago, I would have said, oh, revenue and profit. Like these, if these check, I'm great. Whereas I've now realized that like, yeah, stuff comes and goes. But like, as long as you're just enjoying and the people around you are enjoying what they're doing and you're building something that you can put your name behind that you're proud of, all this stuff follows. So this year is my big motto, is just getting back to that.
Yeah, I love that. And getting into some kind of quick questions to wrap things up.
Yeah.
What do you think is the most overrated marketing trend?
Overrated marketing trend. I don't know if this is overrated, but what I think I'm like putting out there that I think is going to change drastically in the next few years is I actually think Google search is not going to be the beast that it has always been. I think I was even talking to somebody in Google the other day. I think that's going to be going downhill pretty quickly over the next like 12 to 18 months.
Interesting. Yeah, I actually just saw a headline the other day that was saying that Google had seen for the first time a drop in searches since they started. So it's definitely an interesting time.
It's not going, especially the younger generation. They're going through school with ChatGPT. Like,
they'll
never
even
know what Google is.
And what do you think is an underrated channel or strategy right now?
Right now, I think that is really hot. And talking to a lot of brands, TikTok shops is kind of blowing up. If you get it right, you can build quite a bit of momentum really quickly. How I think of TikTok shops is this great new like top of funnel acquisition, because people are doing a lot of discovery on TikTok and now they can just quickly click and buy something. The order value is very small. So I know brands that are usually around like $200 to $300, but they're creating like a TikTok shop bundle that's like a sampler of a product or something like very small that somebody can see a video, quickly click and buy. Well, that just gets them into your ecosystem now. That gets your product in their hand. And I think that's an amazing tool. If you then leverage omnichannel marketing, so your brand, your socials, your searches and email retention, everything on top of that, I think it's a great entry point for brands into new consumers is TikTok Shop.
Yeah, I agree. And favorite resource, book, podcast?
Podcasts. I love podcasts. I'm a Diary of a CEO, a group chat. Jordan West has a good podcast, as well as then Tim Ferriss, Open Residency, a podcast for days.
Where can everyone find you?
You can follow me on Instagram. I'm posting regularly, just Parker_Kump. Or on LinkedIn. And then we're also posting a lot on Tough Media, Tough Media_marketing, MKTG. Thanks for having me.